Hello, dear listeners. Whether you're just finding us or have been with us for a while, welcome. At Dreams and Crimes, we've got a treasure trove of stories waiting to be discovered. We like to describe them as a cozy blanket after a long day of work, or a ticket to a thrilling adventure before bed. If you're a long-time listener, thanks for sticking with us. Your support means the world. Want to take it up a notch? Consider subscribing to Dreams and Crimes on Apple Podcasts or YouTube. We're cooking up something special, turning these stories into videos. We've put a lot of efforts into them, and they're actually super good. And now, let's dive into today's story. The Bloodthirsty Parolee. Anyone who has driven the 180-mile stretch of Interstate 5 from Portland, Oregon to Seattle, Washington, possibly remembers the small town of Centralia, Washington. Not because it's of particularly any historical importance, though it has plenty of history, but mostly it's because it's the halfway point between Portland and Seattle and a convenient place to stop for gas or to grab some fast food. In 1977, Centralia was a town of only 10,000 residents, and neighbouring Chehalis had only about 5,000. Together they were known as the Twin Cities. It was a beautiful rural area surrounded by miles and miles of dense forest in every direction. The story of the murder of 13-year-old Bruce Kim is almost entirely absent on the internet. I only know of the story because I lived only a few blocks from Bruce and he was just a few years older than me. Though we lived close to each other, I barely knew the boy. Bruce had an entirely separate circle of friends. Though only 13, like many other kids in the 70s, Bruce got involved with the wrong crowd. On the evening of New Year's Day in 1977, Bruce Kim attended a house party at No. 7 in the Limac Apartments, an old, run-down apartment building near the railroad tracks at the north end of town. The resident of apartment No. 7 was an older man who was known to have parties to which anyone could come, drink, party, or buy some weed or LSD, regardless of age. On New Year's Day, friends had seen Bruce riding his bicycle on the streets of Centralia, but that evening he didn't return home after the party. The next morning, Bruce's mother, Joan, called the Centralia police. "He has never stayed out overnight without calling me. He wouldn't have gone away willingly." Bruce's bicycle was in front of their house at 1002 L Street, but he was nowhere to be found. Bruce was small for his age and had long reddish-brown hair. The last anyone had seen him, he was wearing blue jeans, a jean jacket, and a printed T-shirt. There were no clothes missing from his closet, and he had very little money to his name, so police ruled out the chance that he had simply run away from home. Local detectives immediately contacted Bruce's closest friends to try to backtrack his last known events. That's when they found out that he had attended the party in the Limac Apartments. Detectives spoke to the resident of the apartment, who gave police a list of attendees of the party as best he could remember. They then spent the next few days tracking down the attendees and questioning them one by one. Unfortunately, the apartment was a known drug den and most of the partygoers that attended weren't too excited to speak to police. The interviews uncovered no new clues in tracking down the boy. Just before midnight on January 6th, a man ran to the Centralia Fire Department and pounded on the locked doors. It was late, and nobody was answering. He had just run 6 blocks from the Limac Apartments, which was engulfed in flames. Frustrated, he ran another 3 blocks to the police department, who then alerted the fire department. By the time fire trucks arrived at the Limac Apartments, it was too late. By morning, the building was nothing but charred black sticks and rubble. When the fire marshal assessed the damage, at first glance it seemed clean. There was no evidence of accelerants. The building was very old and had archaic wiring, so the chance of the cause of the fire being faulty wiring was a high. But intuition told him it was more than that. He suspected an experienced arsonist. When the fire marshal heard that the building was the last place Bruce Kim was seen alive, it only solidified his suspicions. The cause of the fire was initially determined to be inconclusive. Centralia detectives told reporters. If Bruce Kim's body had been in the apartment, there would have been some evidence of his remains in the fire debris. Fragments of bone, something. It is extremely rare for a body to be completely destroyed in a fire, even a Holocaust as fully involved as that of the Limac. As the days passed, police grew frustrated at the lack of clues. But on January 13th, their luck turned. A woman named Susan Reagan called the county sheriff and told him she had something to show him. The woman told him that Bruce Kim was most likely dead and showed him a pair of blue jeans that her brother had left with her. The cuffs of the jeans were stained with what appeared to be blood. She was holding the jeans for her brother, and she was clearly terrified. The lead investigator recalled, "She says Tommy brought her the jeans and told her he'd gotten the stains on the cuffs when he'd turned a body over with his foot." Susan Reagan was the brother of 33-year-old Tommy Reagan, a name that was well known to the Centralia Police and the Lewis County Sheriff. Tommy's conflicts with police dated back to his teenage years. Even as a teenager, Tommy Reagan was in trouble with the law. At 15 years old, Reagan had stolen a car and was confined to the Green Hill School, Washington's maximum security lockup for older juveniles. One night, Reagan and another young inmate broke out of the school, stole a 1.5-ton vehicle, and went on a rampage. The two went the wrong way up the highway, crashing through a police barricade, ramming six other cars, and almost running over a police officer. They led police on a 45-mile high-speed pursuit before they were finally stopped. Over the next 17 years, Reagan spent more time in prison than out, with charges ranging from burglary, larceny, and car theft to rape and kidnapping. The worst of his offences was when he was 20 years old. Reagan was charged with kidnapping a 14-year-old boy named Bobby at knife point. Reagan approached two young boys after a baseball game in Fort Borst Park and asked for help to push his car. When they started pushing, Reagan pulled a switchblade knife on them. One boy ran away, but Reagan grabbed Bobby and dragged him into the forest, cutting him several times in the ribs with the knife. Once in the forest, he sodomized the boy and dragged him across the Skookumchuck River. The boy that got away had alerted police, and Bobby was able to get away when Reagan was distracted by police sirens. At the time, Reagan was only charged with kidnapping, but years later the boy confided the entire story to police that he was orally and anally raped by Reagan at knife point. Coincidentally, Bobby went on to be one of Centralia's few celebrities, playing Major League Baseball for 5 years. At the time of Bruce Kim's disappearance, Tommy Reagan was out on parole. His address at the time was 90 miles away in Seattle, but he had been visiting family in Centralia. Reagan had also been an attendee at the party in the Limac apartments. In fact, police had questioned him in the days after. Detectives were very keen to question him further, since they had the additional information about the bloody jeans. Detectives needed to find Tommy Reagan. According to his parole officer in Seattle, he was living with someone named Christina Kathana Kempf. Christina's past was every bit as sordid as Reagan's. She was actually born Charles Wheeler. At an early age, he realized that he had a boy's body, but identified as a girl. "All I knew was I wanted to be a girl, and I wasn't." In his teens, Charles assumed he was just gay. He was married at 16, but was divorced by 21. "The homosexual life was a disappointment. I wanted to talk love and marriage, pots and pans, and they wanted to talk sex." After the divorce, Charles turned to alcohol and entered a traumatic depression that landed him in the Easter State Mental Hospital with a diagnosis of incipient schizophrenia. Upon release from the hospital, Charles decided to become Christine. She changed her name and started wearing women's clothes and makeup. She desperately wanted to make it official by getting a sex change, but she lacked the funds for the expensive procedure. It wasn't long before Christina was arrested and sentenced to 20 years in prison for cashing stolen checks, but was released after only 3 years. Within 20 days of her release, she was arrested again, this time for murder. According to Christina, she was accosted in the parking lot of a grocery store by a man that was trying to force her to have sex. During the altercation, she stabbed the man to death. Christina was sentenced to life in prison in the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, a men's prison. Identifying as a woman, she was harassed in prison and ridiculed for being a cross-dresser. Prison psychologists criticized her, telling her that she was just homosexual. Though she was sentenced to life in prison, she was released in 1973. Upon her release, an anonymous donor had sent her $1,000 to start a fund to help her pay for a sex change. The anonymous donor ended up being an odd, flamboyant church in Seattle. The donation wasn't enough for a full sex change, so Christina got breast implants and started hormone therapy. In the spring of 1973, Christina had married again, this time to a man named Andy. The wedding took place in a huge, opulent mansion on Lake Washington that was the headquarters of the church that gave her the donation. The preacher of the church and owner of the mansion was a large, eccentric man with 40D fake breasts who dressed in flowing silk robes. The church televised their wedding and paid for their honeymoon in Hawaii. The marital bliss didn't last long. Both Christina and Andy were arrested on drug charges and sentenced to prison. They arrested Christina as Charles Wheeler, and she shared a cell with her husband, Andy. After only 18 months, Christina was out of prison again and moved into an apartment in Seattle with Tommy Reagan while Andy still sat in jail. On January 14th, Centralia detectives were still searching for Tommy Reagan. They had pulled him over in his 1960 Green Corvair on January 12th for a traffic violation, but that was before he was wanted for questioning, and nobody had seen him since. In addition to the Corvair, Reagan often drove a brown 1965 Barracuda, which belonged to Christina Kempf. Police were on the lookout for both vehicles, but were cautious, knowing that he may be armed. It was rumoured that Reagan often carried a sawed-off 22 caliber rifle. The Seattle police were looking for Reagan too. Neither Christina nor Reagan were at their Seattle apartment. That same day, Centralia detectives went back to Reagan's sister's house to see if they could get any more information out of her, and they were in luck. His sister was nothing like her brother. She didn't want any part of him if he had murdered a 14-year-old boy and told police exactly what Tommy had told her. She told police that Reagan admitted to her he had killed Bruce Kim. She said that Tommy told her he had buried the body somewhere near Yelm, Washington, a tiny town about 30 miles northeast of Centralia. The problem was, Centralia was surrounded by dense forest, and Yelm was even more so. It would take a miracle to find a grave in such a vast wilderness without more specific information. Centralia police contacted the Yelm police for help. Reagan had some prison buddies in the area that they thought he might stay with, but they hadn't heard from him. When police checked on the status of the 1960 Corvair, they saw that Reagan had just sold it the day before, January 13th, the day after he had been pulled over for a traffic violation. Detectives contacted the new owners of the Corvair and impounded the vehicle. The new owners quickly stopped payment on the check that they wrote to Reagan before he could cash it. Inside the car, they found what looked like bloodstains on the seats and tiny bits of dirt. On the bottom side of the car, they saw that the undercarriage had recently scraped something. Their assumption was that Reagan had bottomed out the car somewhere on an old logging trail in Yelm when he was disposing of the body. That same evening, January 14th, Seattle police found Reagan and took him into custody for breaking parole. On the 90-mile drive in the back of a patrol car back down to Centralia, he kept his mouth shut. Reagan's sister was desperately trying to distance herself from her brother. She had very little doubt that her brother had killed the boy, and she called police one more time. When detectives came to her house, she gave them two items that Tommy had left with her, a shovel still covered with dirt and a pocket knife. She also had a little more information than she let on the first time. She told detectives that she didn't know the exact location that he had buried him, but said, It's supposed to be near the Cougar Mountain area of Yelm. There's an old logging road, a mud hole where you have to turn and go through a fence, a kind of rise in the land as the road bends around. There are trees, just small fir trees. Police hypothesised that the rise in the land was where Reagan may have bottomed out the Corvair. On the morning of January 16th, a search team of officers scoured the area near Cougar Mountain. The January weather in southwest Washington was notoriously miserable, rainy and wet, making old logging roads muddy. The terrain in the Yelm Forest was filled with thick blackberry bushes, vines and fir trees. Searching a forest so thick and overgrown was almost pointless, and the first day of the search was a failure. The next day, the crew searched again. This time they were armed with aerial maps of the area and plaster impressions they had taken from the Corvair tyres. At a fork in an old logging road, they came across their first clue. A match in the mud to the Corvair tyres. They followed the Corvair tracks and further up the old road found a hump that could have caused the scratch marks on the bottom of the car. Detectives took dirt samples from the road, hoping they could later match it to the dirt found on the underside of the Corvair. Where the tracks seemed to end, police spread out to search the dense forest. Most of the police in the area were also regular deer hunters and had a lot of experience rummaging through the thick woods. About 100 feet into the forest from the logging road, one detective noticed a fallen tree that had recently been burned. He thought he may be onto something. There were also what seemed to be drag marks in the mud near the log. Not far from the log, he noticed a patch of buffalo grass. The grass wasn't planted in the ground, though. It seemed as if it had been torn away and was lying on the ground. It was obvious that someone had intended to hide something beneath. The team was called to the site, and they dug very lightly, using only their hands. The dirt was fresh and not packed down. Just 6 inches below the surface, they reached flesh. As they pushed the dirt aside, they could tell it was the back and hip of a small person, face down. There were what appeared to be slashes and scratches across the back. As they cleared the dirt away from the rest of the body and reached the neck, they realised there was a massive gash. But nothing could prepare them for what they saw next. As they continued to dig, they realised that it wasn't a gash at all. The head had been completely severed. There was no head at all in the grave. When the decapitated body was pulled out of the shallow grave and laid on the ground, it was clear that someone had tried to dissect the limbs, but failed. Other joints were cut, but not all the way through. Possibly the killer was unaware just how hard it is to dismember a body. When they rolled the body over onto its back, they were in for another shock. They could tell that the body was male, but the genitals had been severed completely. Additionally, there was a massive gash from the pubic bone up to the chest. As the day progressed, investigators painstakingly processed the crime scene, scouring the area for anything the killer may have left behind. All they found were some scraps of toilet paper with a distinctive brown floral print on them. The body was taken back to Centralia, and they brought a forensic pathologist up from Portland, Oregon for the post-mortem examination. Although investigators knew this had to be the body of Bruce Kim, they would still need some confirmation of identity. The cold January weather was helpful as it had minimised decomposition. Bruce had never been fingerprinted, and since they didn't find a head buried with the body, they couldn't identify him by dental records. Just a year earlier, however, Bruce had suffered a severe leg break. When the body was x-rayed, it showed the break. The break matched with the x-rays on file with Centralia General Hospital. It was indeed the body of Bruce Kim. During the autopsy, Bruce's blood alcohol level was read at 0.21, an impossibly high level for anyone, let alone a 13-year-old boy. Decomposition and the extreme blood loss can alter the reading, though, so the pathologist wasn't sure that it was accurate. Tommy Reagan was in lockup for parole violation, and he wasn't talking. Investigators then retraced all of his movements since the first of the year. They already knew that he was at the party at the Lee Mack apartments. They also learned that he borrowed a shovel from a prison friend of his at 1:30 p.m. on January the 3rd, returning it later that evening. They also learned that he had slept in Christina Kempf's barracuda one block from the Limac apartments on the night of the fire. He had also been seen in the Yelm area near where the body was found on January 12th. Though they had found what they thought to be bloodstains and mud in the Corvair, none of that evidence was usable. Christina Kempf was still nowhere to be found, and police desperately wanted to speak to her. They were unsure if Reagan may have had help with the murder. On January 20th, police got a warrant to search Reagan and Christina's apartment in Seattle and her barracuda. Inside the apartment, detectives found work gloves caked with dirt and maps of the Yelm area, along with miscellaneous paperwork that belonged to Tommy. In the paperwork were several handwritten pages penned by Reagan. It was the story of a homosexual killing involving two killers and one victim. They also found rolls of toilet paper with a brown floral print, exactly the same as the shreds they found near the gravesite. The search warrant, however, was very specific, and one detective spotted something that could be useful but legally wasn't included in the warrant. They needed the signature from a superior court judge to get an additional warrant, but it was late at night. That night they found a judge to sign for a second warrant and went back to the apartment again. The item they wanted was a photo they'd seen in a photo album. One picture in particular showed Reagan staring wide-eyed into the camera framing his face. On both cheeks were smears of red liquid that looked like blood in the shape of a pentagram, a five-pointed star pointed downward, often associated with the occult or devil worship. Investigators now questioned whether Bruce Kim had been murdered as part of some sort of cult ritual. Detectives later questioned every tenant of the Seattle apartment building. In that questioning, they found that Christina owned a third car, a Toyota that was still sitting in the parking lot. With another warrant, police searched the car and found pickaxes, dirt, ropes, and an army shovel. Another tenant told detectives that Christina had confided in them that Reagan had told her he accidentally hit a young boy with his car, breaking his neck. According to Christina, Reagan panicked and buried the boy. Police knew there was no truth in this story. Bruce's body had no broken bones and no bruising to indicate being hit by a car. Detectives still needed to talk to Christina, but she was nowhere to be found. The next obvious person to talk to was the church minister who had conducted her wedding and paid for her breast implants and honeymoon to Hawaii. When police arrived at the church minister's opulent mansion, it was clear they had stumbled onto a cult of sorts. It seemed that many people lived at the mansion, with dramatic artwork, 2-inch-thick shag carpet, and a view overlooking Lake Washington. Another thing they noticed right away was that the room they were in was the background in Reagan's pentagram photo. The picture had been taken there. One of the women at the mansion remembered Reagan and said she was the person that took the photo of him. She claimed it was all just a joke, and she painted the pentagrams on his face. Ultimately, the residents barely remembered Reagan. They said they hadn't seen Christina in quite some time and had no idea where she might be. In a strange coincidence, there was an article in the Sunday, January 30th edition of the Seattle newspaper about Christina. The article wasn't about the police search for her, but rather a sympathetic piece about the struggles with homosexual and transgender life, featuring a photo of her lounging in silk pyjamas, showing her artificial cleavage. The newspaper had no idea about the search for her and her possible involvement in a horribly sadistic murder. On February 8th, Christina gave up hiding from police and walked into the police station with an attorney. She insisted she had nothing to do with the murder and had no knowledge of it at all and therefore could give no testimony. But when prosecutors offered her immunity to testify against Reagan, she quickly took it. Tommy Reagan was initially charged with aggravated murder, meaning that a murder was committed in the course of or in furtherance of the crime of rape or kidnapping. It was the only crime in Washington state punishable with a mandatory death sentence. Prosecutors believe that Bruce had been sexually assaulted before he was killed, and the death was an attempt to cover up the crime of rape. Once Reagan was behind bars, detectives revisited Bobby, the young boy that had been kidnapped by Reagan 13 years earlier. It was then that Bobby broke down and told police of the rape. He told detectives he was severely traumatized and thought of himself as lucky to be alive. He told detectives that Reagan took him into the woods, tied him up, put the switchblade to his throat, and told him he would cut off his genitals if he wasn't cooperative. Even with Bobby's testimony, prosecutors knew that trying to prove aggravated murder would be a stretch. When word got to the public that Reagan had been charged, another witness came forward. A man that was at the LEMAC party in the early hours of January 2nd told police that he saw Reagan having sex with Bruce Kim. Though this information didn't suggest the sex was forced and showed nothing to prove that Reagan murdered him, it still helped solidify the case. The trial was set for late April, but just before the start date of the trial, Reagan's attorney told police that he wanted to talk. Reagan and his attorney asked for a deal. Reagan offered to plead guilty to a lesser charge of second-degree murder. To sweeten the deal, Reagan told detectives he would show them where he buried Bruce Kim's head. Reagan had already been convicted of three felonies, making him a likely candidate to be bitched, a slang term used to describe a habitual criminal. If prosecutors could get Reagan convicted as a habitual criminal, he would be sentenced to life and would likely never be released. On April 18th, Reagan pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and led detectives to the head of Bruce Kim. Investigators considered themselves lucky to find the body, but it would have taken a miracle to find the head on their own. The lead detective said it was buried in brush so thick a coyote wouldn't crawl through it. The head was located in dense blackberry bushes about 300 yards from the gravesite. Using dental records, the identity was confirmed to be that of Bruce Kim. Reagan told police he had thrown Bruce's clothes from the car as he was driving along the logging road. Backtracking the road, police found several pieces of his clothes. Reagan then explained the details of the killing to detectives. He claimed that they both left the party at the LEMAC apartments and went to Bruce's house. They were both extremely drunk and Bruce swore at Reagan, which threw him into a rage. Reagan said he wrapped his hands around his neck and started to strangle the boy. Bruce was much smaller and younger than Reagan. "I didn't realize I had killed him. I thought he was breathing." When Reagan finally released his grip, it was too late. Bruce was dead. He said he then put Bruce's body into the trunk of the Corvair and drove to Seattle. Later, he drove back down to Yelm and buried it. He told police he cut off his head at the gravesite to avoid identification. When asked why he cut off Bruce's genitals and where they were, he had no recollection of it. He claimed to not remember anything about any additional mutilations, the slash marks, or the attempted dismemberment. Reagan insinuated that he must have blacked that out. Because of the media attention in the Centralia area, Reagan's trial was moved from Lewis County to Pacific County. One evening when driving back to the Lewis County jail with the Centralia chief of police, they passed a familiar hamburger stand. Reagan lamented that he would probably never taste another milkshake for the rest of his life. Chief Jones was a firm believer that all men deserved some sense of dignity, regardless of what they may have done in their lives. He stopped by the drive-in and bought Reagan what was most likely his last milkshake. Jones's kindness eventually paid off. A few days later, Reagan asked to speak to Chief Jones. Reagan said, "It came down just like you had it put together. I trust you. I won't talk to anyone but you. There are some things I could clear up if I knew I wouldn't get prosecuted for it. I could clear the board some." In an extremely controversial move, Chief Jones spoke to prosecutors and asked to grant immunity for Reagan from any prosecution for crimes other than homicide or crimes out of his jurisdiction. The prosecution agreed. Reagan then admitted to setting the Limack apartments on fire. On the evening of January 5th, just before midnight, Reagan was parked near the building. "It was so ugly. I just went back to burn it down because it was ugly." He told police that he was drunk and simply wedged newspaper into the frame of the building and lit it ablaze. He also admitted to setting several other fires in the area, including forest fires, buildings and bridges, with no regard for human life. He said he always just used newspapers and a match. He then confessed to several other burglaries, larcenies, assaults, and another rape of a young boy. Reagan was found guilty of second-degree murder, being a habitual criminal, second-degree assault with a deadly weapon in the first degree, and 2 counts of sodomy. In an unprecedented move, the prosecutor tried him for a second habitual criminal charge, strictly to solidify the chance that he would never be released. Under our present system of perpetual appeals and post-conviction writs, no condition is 100% solid. Tommy Reagan was convicted of a total of 7 felonies in Washington and another burglary conviction in Alaska.
Thanks for listening to True Crime Sleep Stories. If you aren't asleep yet, consider following the show. Maybe our next story will give you the peace of mind you desperately need. Or not. Thanks for listening to True Crime Sleep Stories. If you aren't asleep yet, consider following the show. Maybe our next story will give you the peace of mind you desperately need. Or not.